Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Here we're coming to the fifth talk of our range retreat. And I always try to restrain myself just to talk about meditation practice for the first half of the retreat and not to allow myself to go off into where that meditation leads to with the insight practice or the understanding of the Dhamma. We're trying just to keep the nuts and bolts about not telling you what you're going to find, but telling you how to find it, how to make that mind so still and so peaceful that the mindfulness gets so strong you can start to see things you're unable to see with ordinary mindfulness. You can penetrate truths which are inaccessible to the ordinary person. And maybe through the very deepest of meditations you can reflect afterwards and get those fruits of the path called stream winning and above. So this is what we're here for, to actually end rebirth, and that's the way you have to do it. Without the deep meditations, there's no real power to the insight practice. That's why I keep on the same focus on how we can deepen our meditation practice. Obviously that 4 or 5 weeks have gone past now, not 4 weeks, yeah, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, yeah, 3.5 weeks have gone past now. And never really think, so much time has gone past, I'm not getting anywhere. Always remember that patience is most important. And that if there is no progress yet, don't be concerned. One keeps on working to build up the steam. There's nothing else to be done. Every one of you has enough understanding of the Dharma that this is the only path which you can walk, the only meaningful thing to do in your life. It doesn't matter how long it takes, we're just going to keep on at the same practice, keeping on going until eventually the mind starts to get peaceful, until the mindfulness starts to get strong, until insights start to come. And when you get to that point, then the whole struggle of the early years of monastic life become understandable, acceptable. One realizes why one had to sort of be this patient. It takes time for these things to grow. Sure, you can get fast paths, but the Buddha said that's like growing trees in the sandy soil down in the plains. And that's what it's like just below this monastery in the plains. On the sandy soil, the trees grow very quickly. Up here in the mountains where there's so many rocks, it takes a long time for the trees to grow. But when the storm comes, the trees in the plain, they haven't got anything to hold on to. They fall over. But the trees up in the mountains, their roots are holding on to the rocks. They're really strong. It takes much longer, but you get greater strength. And that's like our practice of meditation. It takes longer on this path, but you get greater strength. And you become like trees of the mountains rather than trees of the plain. And the worldly winds, they blow from the south, the north, west or east, you remain immovable because you're a mountain tree, a forest monk, someone who has the stability born of samadhi and also of insight. But to be able to get to that place, it's my job to keep on looking at the same process from different angles. And one of the greatest angles which the Buddha gave, the framework of the five hindrances, is like how we can look at our meditation, and instead of just banging on against the same brick wall, instead of getting frustrated, we can actually look and find out why and use the five hindrances as our diagnostic method, finding out why these things are happening. And they're very effective ways of looking at the process of meditation, especially the hurdles which one comes up against. usually in the talks which I give, I always like to be positive and say just not what the hurdles are, but what's on the other side of the hurdles, the beautiful states of meditation, the bliss states, from the beautiful breath to the nimittas and the jhanas and all these incredible states there. But sometimes, in our practice, what we come across is the brick walls, not the nimittas or the bliss. So we have to understand just how we deal with these states and how we get beyond. And always, not sorry, always, but one of the best methods which the Buddha used and laid down is the method of the five hindrances. So that when one gets into one's meditation, one gets up against a problem, it's useful, it's helpful to use the time-tested method coming from the Buddha himself of the hindrances. What is going on? And that first hindrance, sensory desire, there must be some reason why the Buddha called that the first hindrance. And I reckon in the years I've been meditating and practicing, it's because it is the big one. Of all the hindrances, is Kamachanda is number one. Now what Kamachanda means, as I was mentioning to the Anagarika's novices, laymen, laywomen, at the Saturday night talk, Chanda has this meaning of like just approval. You're sort of okay with this. And you can actually understand what that means when you're having thoughts. It may be thoughts of old girlfriends, fantasies, dreams or whatever. And you consent to it. You say, yeah, let's go with this. And that's one of the meanings of this word chanda. Sometimes it's called desire. It may be even like craving, like chandaraga. But here, it's meaning even such a small thing as just consenting to it, allowing it to be, getting into it. And you'll find that any of the problems which happen in the meditation, somewhere that you're getting in there and you're saying, yeah, this is what I want to happen. You're okay with that, rather than just standing back and disengaging. That's a word you've heard me use a lot over the last few months, disengaging. Instead of saying letting go, because that word may be overused, disengaging gives you the metaphor of whatever you are experiencing is out there, and this knower is in here, and you're disengaging the two. You're objectifying. You're separating the knower from the known. Disengaging the two. And you also know that word engagement is what you do when you before you get married, before you get joined up to something. So disengaging is like a separation. It's like another word for detaching. It's another word for letting go, but a more helpful word. So whenever you are having any thoughts in the mind or any feelings, just to try that disengagement. You just watch these things and they're just thoughts. They're just sounds, they're just feelings which go through the body. While disengaging, you're using a little bit of anatta sanya. This is not me, not mine, not a self, nothing to do with me. You're using your wisdom to separate so this mind, and with it the doer, from the experience. Sometimes I call that putting peace between you and the experience. And putting peace in there, it stops the hand going through that peace and manipulating what you're experiencing. And what one does when one comes across a problem in meditation, one tries these tools to see, does this work? When you're meditating and it's not getting anywhere, you say put peace between you and the experience. Does that allow you to disengage and allow whatever that experience is to go through these phases of viraga and nirodha? Viraga is like the fading away of these things. It just disappears, whether it's the fantasy or the thought pattern. It just gets weaker and weaker as you disengage, as you take away your interest in it and your approval. It fades and fades away until it just stops. And just the thought, the fantasy, the memory, whatever it is which has been bugging you, it's just gone. That is the sign that you have disengaged. It goes through that process of viraga and nirodha, of the fading away and eventually cessation. And of course, what comes next is upasama, the peace. It's the whole thing's been pacified and settled. And so one can try putting peace between, you know, what one is experiencing and the experience. And use that metaphor. Now imagine peace to be some cotton wool or this glass, this beautiful crystal or whatever it is. So you use an imaginary metaphor, because the imagination can be used in a positive way. And when you make sort of peace a bit more tangible, something the mind can get around and can hold, then you can put that between you and the experience, and it starts to work. If that doesn't work, you can't do it, you can't get your head around that, then try other things, whether it's just trying loving kindness, trying compassion, whatever it is you put between you and the object. So you experiment with these things. And you can do that at any time of the meditation, even if you're doing nimitta work, and the nimitta just will not become stable. Try putting peace between you and the nimitta, so you can't engage with that nimitta. You have to just separate. And being able to do that sometimes works wonderfully well. And of course, if that can't work, sometimes I just do contentment. Because contentment is another way of overcoming this first hindrance of karma chanda. You should be getting involved in this five-sense world, or the what I sometimes call the echo of the five-sense world, the karma vitaka, the thoughts about the five senses. And you notice that most of the stuff which comes up in the mind, whether it's the thinking, the fantasies, it's all about the world outside. Very few monks have fantasies about jhanas. I don't know why, because that's much more fun. Sometimes, after you meditate, you can have dreams of jhanas. You have dreams of having psychic powers. Those are the fun stuff. You can dream about anything. That's the nice stuff to dream about. Much nicer if you're a man than dreaming about women. It's much more enjoyable. So this is actually what starts, actually, to get into your mind. But the five senses, it's incredible just how that has a hold on our mind. And the reason is that's our world. That's what we're used to. That's where we hang out in. That's where our self lives. And to take us our mindfulness, our gaze away from that five sense world is very scary. We're going to another place when we go to the realm of the mind. And so that's why that sometimes we don't want to let go of that world of the five senses. And that's why we just get involved in it too often. A lot of times we know nothing more. So just saying contentment, 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 is a way of overcoming sort of the grosser forms of attachment to this five sense world. Whatever experience you have in your body, aches and pains, sure, you just try and get it as comfortable as you can, but there comes a point you can go no further. You just give up. Okay, I'm content with this. It comes like with the sounds outside, whether it's the crows or the cockatoos. There comes a time when you just can't do any more, so you're just content with it. There comes a time when, I don't know, usually the sounds and the feelings are the most important of the five senses. If I can just be content with those things, a strange thing happens. When you're content with these things, they too start to fade away and cease. It's basically that nothing to do. When there's nothing to do, the mind disengages. And contentment is another way of overcoming that first hindrance of karma chanda. The grosser forms, I mean, you should know by now, just reflecting on the body, reflecting on the asupa, reflecting on this, the foulness of the body, reflecting on that if you have any sexual relationships with either a person of the opposite gender or the same gender, or food or movies or video games, it's fun in the beginning, it's boring in the end, and afterwards you wonder, what did I waste my time for? Everyone really uses one's wisdom. You know, it should be quite easy to see that world of the five senses has nothing for you. It just ends in old age, suffering and death. Whatever you get involved in, that's the only thing which it ends up in. And all the beautiful food afterwards, 5 or 10 minutes of fun, and it's all gone. You have stomachache in the afternoon. You have a nice fantasy, and afterwards you feel terrible. You have just go out there in the world searching for things, and it's never satisfying. It's the nature of the five senses. They give you the pleasure at first, and you have to pay for it afterwards. That's why the Buddha called it the simile of borrowing goods. Actually, when you indulge in the five senses, you're borrowing happiness. You have a happiness splurge in the beginning, and then you have to pay it all back afterwards. That's why when people follow the way of the five senses, when they follow sensory desire, they get some pleasure, and then they get this deficit, so I have to fill it up with more pleasure. And so it becomes like a person who borrows money and has to borrow from someone else to pay it back with the interest, and borrow again, and the debt keeps increasing and increasing over one's life. So some of you who've come here, you may still be paying off the debt. For those of you who've been here for a while, maybe the debt is beginning to be paid off. And you start to get your real happiness, the happiness which is apart from sensory pleasures. Which is why the Buddha gave that wonderful simile of the fire sticks, which somebody talked about a few days ago. The simile of the fire sticks in the Mahasatika Sutta was that three types of fire sticks, one in the water. You take it out, you can't make a fire with that. You can rub it and rub it and rub it, but it's just too wet. I mean, that's the simile of somebody in the world trying to get jhana and enlightened. It just can't work, you're just too sappy. It's also a play on words. To light a fire, jayati, is similar to the word to meditate, jayatu, to jayato, to do jhanas. Or jayi, rather, the meditator. So, the stick which is out of the water, lying by the side of the river. You can't use that to light a fire either. It's dry on the outside, but it's still got sap on the inside. It hasn't dried out long enough yet. And sometimes that's like a person who's come from the world into this monastery, but hasn't been here long enough yet. They haven't really dried out. For those of you who've been here a while, you've been out of the water, lying a long way away from the river. And maybe you're dry enough for the sensory world not to have any hold on you. If that's not you yet, just imagine if it was. All these sensory demands just aren't important for you anymore. You are free. Sometimes people think of the sensory world as a lovely playground where they can get lots of pleasure. But those who are wiser, Aryas, know that it's not a playground, but it's like a torture chamber. It looks like it's offering you happiness and fun and pleasure. But when you actually move out of there, and you're not under the control of the five senses anymore, it's an amazing sense of freedom. If you're a man, a beautiful girl comes into the monastery and you just don't move. The mind just looks upon that as just another person. You got delicious food, and the mind doesn't move. You can have it, you don't need it. It's no big thing anymore. Even physical pain. Physical pain is part of the body, it's not such a big deal anymore. Imagine that freedom from the demands of the five senses, and how wonderful that would be. This is actually what one is developing in the meditation. When one can just put aside those five senses, sounds, sights, smells, tastes and physical touches, one is free. But it's not just being able to put down these sights, sounds, smells, tastes and touches in the moment. It's the thoughts about them as well which causes a problem. The karma vitaka. So it takes a while for us to completely let go of those. If you can, you've made the biggest step on the path of meditation. You can sit down and the body just disappears, you're not interested in the sounds. and all the stuff which happened earlier on, all about the five senses, just you can let go of. All the five sense stuff in the future you can let go of. So you've let go of that world. That's why the first line, the first phrase in the definition of first jhana is vivicchehi karmehi, having completely left behind the world of the five senses. It is what happens just when the body disappears and the five senses are no longer operating. You can see that process happening with, first of all, kaya prasadi, the tranquility of the body. When you just sit here and the body is not a problem anymore. The itches, the aches, they just don't bother you. In fact, you can't feel them anymore. The hands disappear, the back disappears, the legs, you haven't got a clue where they are. You don't even notice the breath on your tip of your nose. You don't know where the breath is. You don't care where the breath is. The body is disappearing. I often tell people one of the reasons why the Buddha used the breath meditation is because it's a stepping stone to let the body disappear and with it the five senses. But what happens when you focus on the breath and you have enough peace to be able to focus on the breath? Which is why I know it's radical. You know, I've been teaching like this for a long time, but still people sort of think I'm being very radical not to force the mind on the breath from the very beginning, but encourage people to do present moment awareness and silence. Because what happens, you get enough energy coming up, enough peace, enough stability of mind. The worst of the five hindrances are overcome by that preliminary practice of present moment awareness and silence, that you can watch the breath easily. Hopefully, many of you by now have been meditating that enough peace, enough clarity has come up. You can watch the breath and the mind is more sensitive. So it's very similar to, you know, you may be chopping wood with a big axe. And then I come and ask you to sort of write some calligraphy or something. And you can't use the same hands which have been chopping wood all day with a big axe to do something refined. You've got to sort of allow the refinement to sort of develop. And that's pretty much what happens with the mind. So actually to watch the breath is a very, very refined activity of the brain. You can't expect to do that if you've been rushing around thinking and doing so many things. So you need time to allow the mind to settle down, to become refined enough so it knows how to watch the breath. Otherwise, you just crush it because you're just insensitive. So that sensitivity comes up with these beginning practices. And then you can just watch the breath. And one of the important things to notice is that when you first watch the breath, it's a physical sensation. It's part of the sense of touch. It's one of the five senses. But you watch it to the exclusion of all the other senses. So you don't see, you don't hear, you don't smell, taste, and all you touch is the breath. And the rest of the body disappears. That's an important sign. That the rest of the body has disappeared, all you've got left is the breath. But don't try and check that out and say, where is my body? Because as soon as you say that, the body comes up again into your consciousness. Only afterwards you realize that, yeah, you just had the breath and the rest of the body had disappeared. That's the nature of that knowing. And after a while the breath changes. This is where many meditators get confused. The breath disappears and they want to know what to do next. And I've been very consistent with this teaching because I've been conditioning and brainwashing everybody. What to do next is a question which should never come up in your meditation. That sort of question is like doubt. Instead of that, it's what am I doing now? Not what am I doing next. So you don't have to do anything. You just allow the whole process to evolve and stop controlling it. But it's nice to be able to know, it's helpful to be able to know what's going on. And what's going on, as soon as the sense of physical touch turns off, you're still watching the breath but through another sense door. You're not feeling the breath anymore. You are knowing the breath through the mind door. It's a great insight actually to know that and to see that transition. to see just the last of the five senses, the sense of touch with the breath, is turning off. And what's left is the mind seeing something. This is letting go of the five senses. If you can't let go of the breath at all and get to that stage, it is because of karma chanda. You just approve of five sense activity. That's the world which you know, the world which you have always hung out in, and you don't want to leave it. You can't leave it. You're attached to it. That's what attachment means. So it takes a lot of courage, a lot of selflessness, understanding non-self, going past things like fear, to be able to allow the last of the five senses, and here it's the breath, vanish. When it does vanish, don't do anything. Allow it to be, no matter what it is. You're getting used to the sixth sense base, just mind. Obviously, that you've heard me say before, that the more times you do this anyway, it happens naturally. If you can allow the breath to disappear from a place of a beautiful breath, when there's some delight and happiness there, it's much easier to keep your awareness on what's happening next. Simply because you've got more mind energy to play with. It doesn't matter if the breath disappears and you go into blankness. It doesn't matter for the time being. At least you're allowing the five senses to disappear. It's a bit of sloth and torpor, but I don't mind that, as I'm coming up to later with the sloth and torpor hindrance. But the main one is being able to let go of the five senses, to see another world. If you can let go of that five sense world and get to this beautiful mind state, it's like even with a nimitta, it is so attractive, and it becomes so peaceful that you get a different flavor of pleasure. And when you look back upon the world of the five senses of sex, food, video games, chatting, coffee, whatever it is you get into in the five sense realm, and you compare it, which you will do naturally with the experience of a pure mind state released from the five senses, even with nimittas, you know just what is more beautiful, more pleasant, more attractive. And after a while of going to those states beyond the five senses, your craving, attachment, delight, interest in the realm of the five senses starts to disappear. That's why the Buddha kept on saying that in those deep states of jhanas, or even I would say in nimitta stages, the more one hangs out in those stages, the more that things like karma dandha, the craving for sensory existence, the more that gets weakened and weakened and weakened and weakened and weakened. It suppresses things like sexual desire, desire for food, desire for company. Anything to do with the five senses gets suppressed by the experience of something better and purer. And of course, the more one experiences that which is better and purer in the realm of the mind, the more those five sense attachments are weakened, the easier it is to go to those places. So you get the snowball effect again. The more you can get to nimittas, the easier they are to get to. As the first hindrance gets weaker and weaker and weaker. We're letting go of the world, which is what monks are supposed to do. It's the way we do it, through experience of what lies beyond the five sense realm. So if you are still can't get into nimitta state, karma chanda may be your hindrance. Try a little bit of a supa. And it's not just, you know, 32 parts of the body. It's just the objects of the senses, the food in your bowl, the sounds outside of you, even the sunsets, whatever else is part of the five sense realm, the whole lot, not just physical body. See the whole lot for what it is. A prison, not as a playground. As soon as you see that and develop that perception, you'll find your meditation gets deeper and more peaceful. You're overcoming that first hindrance, karma chanda. But there is still, despite just the way I've been trying to run this monastery in a very sort of positive, light-hearted way, there is still that the second hindrance comes up in many Westerners, which is like the ill will, the negativity. And of course the Buddha made it very clear that that's not something to be celebrated. I know in the world outside, to be someone who's negative, cynical, always putting things down, is considered to be cool in many circles. But in meditation it doesn't help at all, being negative. And if you cultivate negativity with that fault-finding mind, you find not only can't you stand your meditation, you can't stand the monastery, you can't stand other people, after a while you can't stand yourself. That negativity is just like a cancer which sort of eats away at people. And just like cancer has radiation therapy, so ill will has the radiation therapy. You radiate loving kindness, obviously. And sometimes it's quite scary just how one is riddled with ill will, even people who don't think they are. That's why there's a few times I've been doing my meditation, coming against a brick wall, I just do loving kindness. Just a tiny bit of metta. And you know the way I do metta, the door of my heart's open to this moment, no matter what it is. To everything to do with this moment, no matter what it is. I'm open to my past, my future, everything. My door of my heart's open without any conditions whatsoever. Just this unconditional mindfulness. When I do things like that, sometimes just the brick wall just vanishes. You just go to that deeper state. Sometimes you're just watching your breath and it's not really solidifying into sort of a beautiful breath. Just loving kindness is great for that wall, because there's sometimes this ill will there. A very subtle form of ill will. Come on, I want to get somewhere. I'm not fed up with the state which I've been in. Been meditating for all this time and I still haven't got jhana yet. Been meditating a whole 10 minutes, come on. Or whatever else it is you're doing. So, remember that ill will, and it's a wonderful way of overcoming it. Just a little bit of loving kindness. Test it out and see what happens. And usually, if that is the hindrance which has been bothering you, there's a little bit of loving kindness. Just immediately softens the wall, starts to melt, and eventually vanishes, and you're through to the other side. The breath becomes beautiful. The whole beauty sort of just becomes a mind object. Because you've got this acceptance, this letting go, this allowing things to be, putting beauty in it, not controlling it. Because that type of metta is a non-controlling, and it's wishing things well. It's amazing just how dysfunctional the human mind can be, that it wishes anything to hurt or to have harm. When you really look at it, it's the most ridiculous thing to want other people to experience pain, misfortune, unpleasantness. And sometimes that's what we do to ourselves. We want ourselves to have harm, unpleasantness. It's an absolutely ridiculous, crazy, dysfunctional thing to think for anyone, to want other people or to oneself. Why do we want to add more pain and suffering in this world? But that's what anger is. I want you to really hurt. I want you to be suffering. I want you to be in pain. Sometimes we say that to ourselves. But those sorts of feelings are very common in Western people because we're in guilt trips. Don't feel guilty about being in a guilt trip. It's just your conditioning, your parents, your culture. We have come from a guilt-ridden Christian culture, and because of that, sometimes it's got into our characters, maybe from lifetimes before, but certainly in our earlier life. Whenever you make a mistake, your parents say, "Don't you feel sorry about that?" And you say, "No," and you get punished even more. So you weren't encouraged to have a forgiving mind in those days. But at least you can now. have loving kindness. Loving kindness towards your meditation. Loving kindness towards your cushion, which you sit on, or your chair. Loving kindness towards your body. Used to use that as a simile for lay people, that when they had a child and the child couldn't go to sleep at night, they used to say, what do you do when that child is in the bedroom there and it can't go to sleep? Do you grab it by the throat and throttle it? You get to sleep, or else if you don't go to sleep for the next 5 minutes, you're going to be in big trouble. And of course the child just gets more wound up. But I've seen meditators do that to themselves. Come on, 3 or 4 weeks gone already. Come on, get your act together, or else. This is the last day of my retreat. Some of you are on retreat, only one more day to go. Come on, get your act together, or else. And it's just like the parent grabbing the child by the throat and shaking it and say, get to sleep or else. And it's obvious when I compare it to trying to get a child to settle down in bed at night. That is completely the wrong attitude. It's obviously not going to work. And so you can see that the way you look at your own mind sometimes. Sometimes that's dysfunction as well. You get frustrated, and the frustration gives rise to anger. I've mentioned before that all frustration comes from cultivating will. Eventually will always meet the brick wall. There's some things which you cannot control. You get frustrated, and the frustration usually gives rise to anger. And the anger just makes it even worse. It brings about a lot of pain for yourself and others. So after a while we see through this. And so we never get angry at our meditation. So check that out. Do you get angry when you meditate? Angry at yourself? Even irritated? If you get irritated, that's the reason why you don't get deep in meditation. It's not that you don't get deep in meditation causes your irritation. It's not failure causes irritation, it's irritation causes failure. So be careful of that one and counter it with a bit of loving kindness, a bit of gentleness and softness and things like patience. And the restlessness and remorse. Even like remorse, this thing which is stuck on the end of restlessness is kukkucha. Anyone who's read the Vinaya in Pali know what kukkucha means. Have I done something wrong? Have you done something wrong today? What have you been thinking about today? What's been happening in your mind? Have you slept too much today? Eaten too much today? Sometimes that remorse comes up and it's insidious. We don't see it, but it stops us becoming peaceful because we think we don't deserve to be peaceful. We don't deserve to get jhanas. We don't deserve to become enlightened. Now don't underestimate that hindrance. That is very strong. It's a type of ill will towards oneself, but it's coming from the kukkucha, the sense of like remorse or guilt, wanting to punish oneself by denying oneself happiness. Which is why that sometimes in funeral services and other times we do forgiveness ceremonies. It's why that before a monk leaves, when they come back, sometimes we do forgiveness ceremonies. If you're having trouble with your meditation, do a forgiveness ceremony to your meditation. Dear mind, whatever I've done by body, speech or mind, I ask your forgiveness. Little things like that, you'll find, have more power than you ever expect. A forgiveness ceremony to your meditation practice means all that's gone so far, you let go. It means you can be free to meditate, as the Zen people say, like a beginner, with a beginner's mind. Free of the burden of the past, with a bit of forgiveness. Because what we usually do carry from the past, not the eggs, but the shit, you know that simile. We carry our mistakes and failures. That's kukkucha. So forgiveness is an antidote which you can try in your meditation practice. The other bit, restlessness. Restlessness, very easy to see, you're down and sitting, you don't want to sit, you don't want to walk, You don't want to stay in your heart. You don't want to be outside. Restlessness of all those hindrances is overcome so powerfully just through contentment. You do put peace between you and what you're experiencing. This is good enough. That can be a mantra which you say to yourself, as many people have done in the retreats which I've given. You're just sitting there, and whenever there's restlessness, you just say, this is good enough. You're not aiming for anything in the future. You're just aiming just to be here with what you're experiencing. You say, this is good enough. When you analyze it intellectually, of course it's good enough. It's here. It's part of nature. This moment has come about because of many, many causes. It has to be like this. So why are you upset about it? Why are you trying to run away from it or change it or control it? So say, this is good enough. This is good enough. This is good enough. It's a powerful mantra of contentment. And it's amazing just how when people have had enough faith to use it, it's worked so powerfully. Many people have got into the first deep meditation through this is good enough. It's counterintuitive because they think, well, if I'm going to get somewhere, I've got to work hard. And this is good enough will just make me lazy and sort of no aspirations, not setting any goals anymore. How can that work? But this is good enough. What it does, it stops the craving and the desire. It stops the doing. It stops that which separates you from the path of stillness. This is good enough is contentment. This is good enough is freedom. That's that meaning of the word mutti, one of the ways of letting go. As said and before, and I won't repeat the simile, that a prison is any place you don't want to be. If you don't want to be here listening to this talk, this is a prison. If you don't want to be in this monastery, the monastery is a prison. Any place or moment where you don't want to be is a jail. And a way to escape from the prisons of meditation is not going anywhere else or doing something else. The way to escape is changing one's attitude from I don't want to be here, I don't want to experience this, to this is good enough. As soon as you say that, this is good enough, as soon as you are content, you're happy to be here, then you are free. So powerful when you do that and you experience that. This is good enough, even if you're tired, even if you've got a toothache, even if nothing is going right for you. This is good enough. Suddenly you're free. And you realize it wasn't what you're experiencing was a problem. It wasn't the object of your mind which was a difficulty. It was the way you were perceiving it. It was a wrong perception which caused the problem. So this is good enough. Stop so much restlessness. You don't look at the faults in the moment. This is good enough. You have an acceptance. And when it's not seeing faults, there's no business to do. When there's no business to do, where can there be restlessness? And you may have known restlessness for most of your life. Restlessness is what the Buddha meant by that simile of the mangy dog. The mangy dog running from one place to another place. And never sort of getting any relief from the mange, which always keeps it running. This is what restlessness is like. You meditate on the breath, nah, that's no good. You meditate on loving kindness, oh, that's no good. You do walking meditation, that's no good. So you study the suttas, that's no good. So you learn the Patimokkha, that's no good. Or you sit around wasting time dreaming, that's no good. It's the restlessness which is the problem. It's overcome through contentment. This is good enough. And it even works in the deeper stages of meditation. You may be not even able to get to the breath. It doesn't matter, this is good enough. Just rest, relax, just make peace. And then the breath comes to you. You may be watching the breath but can't get to the beautiful breath. It doesn't matter. This is good enough. You're watching the breath. At least you're not making bad karma. So stay with the breath. It doesn't matter how the breath is. You say this is good enough. This incredible contentment comes up, and the contentment is the source of the joy. And the breath becomes delightful. Now if you've got the delightful breath but you can't get nimittas, it doesn't matter. Beautiful breath is beautiful. So what do you want it any more for? This is good enough. Nimittas arise because of that attitude. For those of you who have nimittas, now I want jhana. Come on, just how many people here would give their right arm for a nimitta? And you've got a nimitta. Can't that be good enough for you? Why do you always want more? Always want something else? Always want to be the best meditator? Always want to be enlightened? Just like it was another, say, the brownie badge. Just this is good enough. Give up this ego who always want to acquire attainments and stuff. And if this is good enough, then the jhana comes to you. That's how one overcomes restlessness. If that's not the problem, sloth and torpor. Still many meditators here, sloth and torpor. Simply because you haven't been following instructions of letting go. Still been doing too much. That is the cause of sloth and torpor. Simply because the mind has been too active. Hasn't slowed down enough. Some of you, though, have noticed that you're not sleeping so much. You don't need so much sleep. The reason is the mind is waking up. It's got its own source of energy. Sloth and torpor is vanishing. And sometimes you get into these amazing meditations, and it's 2 hours, 1 hour. Sometimes you just can't sleep. And the mind is just so bright and energetic. And it's wonderful having a bright mind. So if you suffer from sloth and torpor, it's because you are still controlling too much. So instead of controlling through willpower, check the 5 hindrances, seeing if you can use wisdom power. Don't be such a dummy and just try and push through, not really understanding what you're doing. Be more sensitive, more skillful, more resourceful. So what am I up against in this moment here? Is it because I've got too much sensory desire? Is it because I've got ill will, a little bit of metta is what I need? Is it because of restlessness, this is good enough is what I want? Whatever it is, try these different strategies. And last of all, the doubt business. The doubt business, the last of those 5 hindrances, overcomes so easily, so well. Just present moment awareness. Because the present moment is all you can ever know for sure anyway. The future is uncertain. The past is just this dim memory. You add so much onto the future and the past. You can never trust it. So yeah, go on and doubt the future and doubt the past. Doubt it 100%. Doubt it until the point you don't trust it 1 second. And then the past and the future will disappear. But don't doubt the present moment, because that's the only thing you've got. So rely on now. Because all the doubt is, what should I be doing? What have I been doing in the past? When even you ask, you know, what is this? If you analyze that properly, it's not really what is this. If you answer what is this, it's a question. You usually say, what was that I just experienced? You always look back on the past. Doubt is mostly backward looking. In the present moment, there's no room for doubt. The mind can't move far enough to create a doubt if it's really in the present moment. So whenever you have any doubt in the meditation, what should I be doing? Should I be watching the breath? I should be watching the loving kindness. Stop that. Don't say what you should do in the future. What am I doing? Present moment awareness. And when one gets into that beautiful present moment awareness, all this doubt business finishes. That's probably why the doubt is the 5th hindrance. Perhaps it's the easiest one to overcome. So those are like hindrances which stop one developing deep meditation. So after every meditation, as many of you who have accompanied me on retreats or seen me teach meditation at Nolamara, you've always heard me, before I finish the meditation, to say, how do you feel, what's happened and why? At the end of the meditation, you assess the meditation, what's been going on, what's been happening. And that's where one learns. Looking back, one sees what the hindrances were, how one overcame these. It's where one gets the knowledge, where one makes progress by reviewing what one did at the end of every meditation. But don't review it during the meditation too much, otherwise you're just making more restlessness. And if you want any directions, I should have mentioned this in restlessness. Sometimes people, they demand to have some direction in their meditation. If you haven't been brainwashed enough yet by all these Wednesday night talks or understanding what you should be doing, you can always just, as I often mentioned in the interviews, to do programming mindfulness. The beginning of the meditation or a few times during the meditation, you can just interrupt the whole process and just make a little programming. May my mind or may my mindfulness watch the breath. May my mindfulness watch the breath. May my mindfulness watch the breath. It gives it a little bit of directing, and then you shut up and are quiet. You allow mindfulness to do the job you just said. With programming mindfulness, please make it very clear and precise exactly what you want the mind to do. And then be patient and give the mind time to do that. You'd be surprised how powerful that can be. It gives you direction, but without the restlessness of a mind which is always giving orders. Imagine if that was me who gave you orders. I gave you a job to do, such as like, you know, tidy up the dhanasala where we eat. And as you were tidying up the dhanasala, I was always right behind you, telling you how to use the vacuum cleaner, telling you how to put the spittoons out, telling you how to sort of mop the floor. If I was right behind you, imagine what that would be like. Giving you orders every second. You get really pissed off at me. And quite rightly so. And I use that metaphor because that's very often how you meditate. As if you're always on your own case, on your back. It's always telling you what to do, never giving the mind a chance to do the job. And I know from years of being a senior monk in monasteries, if you want a job to be done, all you need to do is to give clear instructions, exactly what you want that monk to do, and trust them. And 9 times out of 10, they will do the job. Do their own way, maybe better than, you know, you wanted it to be done. Sometimes worse, but at least it gets done according to their way. And it's very peacefully done. You have to give clear instructions and trust. So trust your mind. Give it clear instructions. And stop being a little dictator. Always telling your mind what to do and always telling it off and slapping it around when it doesn't do the right thing. So if you can actually follow this practical path of the 5 hindrances, the Buddha said they are the problems to meditation. And if the Buddha said it, that's got huge amounts of weight. Whatever the Buddha said, he was obviously the wisest, best meditator. So if the Buddha says the 5 hindrances is what's stopping you developing deep meditation, they said it's the 5 hindrances which weaken wisdom. Please take that teaching very seriously and just put it into practice. I don't know how your meditation has gone so far, but if it hasn't got into the deep states yet, it is because of the 5 hindrances, or one of them. So keep them in mind, check them out, and use these little strategies, whether it's this is good enough, or the door of my heart's open to this moment, putting peace between whatever you're experiencing and this. If you do things like that, present moment awareness, so there's no doubt can come up, you'll find that what the Buddha said actually works. He didn't sort of teach in vain, he didn't become the famous teacher for no reason. These teachings, this Dhamma, is powerful, it does work. And so if you apply it, then you too get into the deep meditations. And then you have more faith in this, what the Buddha taught. Because you find it works. And it gives you the happiness, the power, the deep meditations, the mindfulness, the insights. And then you're having a wonderful retreat. And of course, that's what I want for each one of you. May each one of you just break through those five hindrances, to leave the world of the five senses, experience a beautiful breath and nimittas, and maybe even jhanas. May you each have fun during this retreat. Not the fun of the world, but the fun of enlightenment. That's the end of the talk.